Welcome to the Greedy Little Podcast with me, Elizabeth Hodson. This week, we're talking food halls, one of my favourite culinary destinations, because what greedy guzzler wouldn't want the heavenly dilemma of choosing between a multitude of delicious comestibles? Later in the podcast, I'll be talking to Petra Barron, founder of Curb, which gives advice to food startups and runs events, food markets, and since 2020, a food hall in Covent Garden. Curb feels like a mini empire now, but Petra's journey started in a rather humbler way.
I tried to get a pitch on Portobello Market, and then I realised it's very hard to get a pitch unless someone dies. And I thought, I can't wait around for that. It could be years. I'll just do it in a van. So I decided I was going to start a chocmobile.
We'll hear more about Petra's adventures in a few minutes, but first, let's go back to a hot and humid day in Singapore. It's January 2004, and I'm wandering around Singapore massively hungover. It's my first time in the city, and last night I somehow ended up at a lesbian speakeasy where I fluked to win in a pool contest. The prize turned out to be a hell of a lot of gin straight from the bottle. It's incredibly humid, and every vestige of moisture is disappearing from my already dehydrated body. Why did I have to have that last swig of gin? Why did I go to the after party for yet more gin? Why can't I see properly? I should really have stayed in bed, but I'm only here for 5 days and I'm determined to do what I came here for, and that's to eat. I'm living in Japan, teaching English, and I've heard mixed reports about Singapore. Some people say it's boring, others obsess about the strict spitting and chewing gum laws. But even the naysayers agree on one thing, that the food is stupendous. And it's the hawker stalls which I'm particularly drawn to. I've read too much about the white radish omelette, Hainanese curry rice and pork rib soup to surrender to my gin sweats. 2004 is pre-smartphone era, so I pull out my crumpled map and deduce that the nearest hawker market is the Newton Food Centre. Gulping on a bottle of sweetened tea, I set off on what appears to be a short walk to Salvation. I estimate it'll take about 15 minutes. My estimate is wrong. 45 minutes later, sweating profusely and swearing even more profusely, I'm about to give up and eat ice cream in one of the many air-conditioned shopping malls. And then I see it. The Newton Food Centre, my theatre of dreams. A central courtyard of seating is surrounded by dozens of stalls, advertising their wares with colourful backlit menu boards. I've come across food courts before, of course, in the various shopping centres of northern England, but the nuggets and chips of Meadow Hall are a world away from the stingray and sambal sauce, shaved ice with agar beans, and the dish that brought me here in the first place, chilli crab. I go through the motions of deciding what to have, but I made my decision back in November when I booked the flight. Although I'm fleetingly tempted by the stingray, the chilli crab wins out. "How many is it for?" asks the stall holder. "Oh, it's just me," I reply. "You're having a whole chilli crab? Just you?" The stall holder is incredulous. "Yes," I answer, embarrassed. I'm given a ticket number and told to find a table. I buy a hollowed-out coconut drink and wait for Salvation. 246, shouts the lady from the stall. She hands me an enormous white plate, filled to the edges with a fierce red gloopy sauce, and in the middle, the biggest crab I've seen outside a wildlife documentary. I now realise why the stallholder balked at the notion of this being a one-person meal. For a small extra charge, there's the option to add rice or bread to mop up the juice, but this is a mountain that has to be climbed by itself. So I take a fistful of utensils and go into battle. I crack open the claws and dig out scoops of the most succulent crab meat I've ever encountered. The delicious, gooey piquant sauce slips off the side of my plate and lands in globules on my new American Eagle t-shirt. There is now an audience of bemused locals, transfixed by this small, gluttonous vision in casual wear, slopping sticky bits of crustacean over the white, clean plastic furniture of the food hall. I feel like the greedy boy in Roald Dahl's Matilda, who is forced to eat a family-sized chocolate cake all to himself, except this is voluntary. I need no encouragement as I excavate every nook and cranny of this noble and delicious king of the sea. Since moving to Japan, I've learnt the word umami, shorthand for true, deep deliciousness, and this Singapore crab is umami to the power of umami. After 30 minutes of concerted eating, the plate is clean, and my hangover has miraculously disappeared. I leave the Newton Food Centre, and then I notice a text on my phone. It's from one of the women at the Underground Speakeasy, asking if I want to play pool again tomorrow night. That's a great offer, I reply, but I've got a date with a stingray. Food halls and hawker markets have been part of Singaporean culture for decades, and the UK has a lot of catching up to do, but things are changing. Kerb, founded by Petra Barron, is now at the forefront of the food hall movement in London and beyond, but Petra's involvement in food started off in a rather more modest way.
When I was in Italy, I'd been working on yachts for a really long time, and I was literally on my knees. I can't do this anymore. I can't continue to clean these boats with Q-tips and toothpicks. I'm going out of my tiny little mind. And I was like, there's got to be more. I need to do something else. And I had this epiphany in my moment of desperation, which I think is when so many realizations dawn on us, isn't it? That the next thing I needed to do was get into the food world. And I didn't know what that meant. This was like 2004, and I discovered the slow food movement. I'd never even heard of it. My friends were telling me about it. I was like, oh my God, this is so exciting. You know, when you just sort of stumble on this new thing and your whole world opens up and you just didn't know it existed. I went back to London after a couple of ill-advised jobs in food. I thought, I've got to do my own thing. And I had another vision one night with my cousin who lived on Portobello Road at the time. She was saying, yeah, the food stalls on Portobello Market do so well. I've stood and counted the number of sales they do. It's mental. But what they don't have is a chocolate stall. And I was always obsessed with chocolate. I was taken to Cadbury World for my 15th birthday on a magical mystery tour by my mum. And it was this another moment of like, oh my God, of course I've got to do something in chocolate. How have I never thought of this? And I tried to get a pitch on Portobello Market, and then I realised it's very hard to get a pitch unless someone dies. And I thought, I can't wait around for that. It could be years. I'll just do it in a van. So I decided I was going to start a chocmobile, a chocolate ice cream van. I started looking on eBay.
Petra found her dream van in Inverness, which she converted into a mobile chocolate and ice cream emporium, eventually getting pitches at events, festivals and markets. But back in the mid-2000s, Petra and her contemporaries in the incipient modern street food movement, people like Yanni Papoutsis, who founded the meat liquor chain, weren't lauded as pioneers. They were seen more as an inconvenience.
There was just a, like, us against the world kind of spirit out there, because you're not really wanted, you're not really legit. You're an informal economy, essentially, which hasn't been made space for by the wider legal form of trading. You know, like street traders were ushered into markets back in the 1960s, like hawkers were frowned upon. And it was like, if you're going to hawk, you have to do it at a market pitch so we can control you, where we know where you are, where we can account for you. So being peripatetic has always been not the dumb thing. And I one day suddenly thought, hang on, we're so much stronger if we're together in a more organized way. We're vulnerable on our own. Like, we can be pushed around by events organizers, we can lose money, we're less visible. You know, there's so much great stuff out there. If we cluster together, we make ourselves more visible. We allow other people to spot what we're doing and come and join us or come and eat from us. And if you put all the good businesses together, you all run a better race.
The entity that you set up, Kerb, has now really become a part of the food establishment, and you're now mentoring other people who want to come into the business. I think you had the incubator sessions back in January. What kind of new ideas are coming through that you're now excited about that might form the basis of the new generation of food stalls and food sellers?
We've really evolved since we launched in 2012. And today, our model focuses on three areas: incubator, food hall operator, and event caterer. I think it's going to be really interesting. I mean, I always talk about how Kerb was launched in the wake of the last recession, and this is going to throw up ever more opportunities, just like that last recession did, and ever more churn and ever more changing of attitudes. I think it's just going to be really homespun stuff. I think there's going to be less bells and whistles and just more like guts. And I think people really respond to that. I think there's going to be a lot of focus on things being local to them. And I think this is a really great time for everyone to, you know, relook at why are they doing what they're doing and why do they care so much about doing that thing, and realizing that you're going to have to care to get back out there and save your business. What's really invigorating about now is like it's going to throw up so many new ideas, but so many refined existing ideas.
Curb is doing really well, but other parts of the high street are in trouble. And there's talk of some of the now closed branches of Debenhams, for example, being turned into food halls. So is that something that would appeal to Petra?
I think the only thing to think about is what's the intent behind it. And if the intent is some big landlord who's suddenly got himself loads of empty Debenhams going, God, I'll just jam it with food, that's probably not going to be a particularly interesting or people-driven experience, although it might well fulfill a need, but I wouldn't have thought it would have enough meat to it to make it truly believable. I'm curious to see what will happen to all of those empty Debenhams and Pals, and I'm sure some of them will turn into food halls. We're not interested in that ourselves. We want to open somewhere else, but we want it to be somewhere that feels really special and feels right. We're not in a hurry. It's going to be a really interesting time watching how this plays out with all this empty space and opportunity to do deals and desire to be together. I think it's going to be really interesting.
If you could have any venue for your next Curb food hall, and you've already got one in Seven Dials in Covent Garden in London, where would that be?
Somewhere that is just juicy, you know, somewhere that just excites us, a city that is exciting to us, a space that is exciting to us, a landlord that we get on with. You know, having a good relationship with your landlord is so important, as we've seen. Thank God we've got a good relationship with ours at Seven Dials. Otherwise, we might be in a very different position right now. Somewhere that we're really excited by, that's the kind of direction we want to go in, because that's the spirit that's going to fill the place and ultimately, hopefully, make it attractive to other people to want to come and to work there and to eat there and to just be there.
It's always good to end on an optimistic note, and so it's goodbye for now. But if you've enjoyed listening, please subscribe to the Greedy Little Podcast and post a review, and I'll be back again soon with another Greedy Little interview.